hard times I'm with you wherever you go. Hard times they'll follow you from door to door. People are running from door to door.
This is recording now, sir. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing today?
Honestly, a bit sore and a wee bit worried. We're over at Jane's, and poor wee Nathan's been asked to. They've asked to take Nathan back in, give him some phototherapy. He's got jaundice, and he just needs a bit of a break, you know. So just a wee bit worried about him, and then. Yesterday I was out with my work at the Kennyhill Allotments in Ridgeray, which is a suburb of Glasgow. We were helping out the Ridgeray Adult Training Centre. It's a centre for adults with varying degrees of sort of learning difficulties. There's about 53 of us out there, basically. You know, tidying up the allotment, the space that they've been given. An allotment is basically, if you imagine a series of back gardens or yards all put together in this sort of communal space whereby people can grow their own plants in quite sort of urban city areas. You probably call them something different over in Texas. So we were over there. They'd been given some space, so we were over there fixing it up for them. You know, we got so far, we didn't get finished, and hopefully another of the teams from the bank will go and fix it. But it was just great to work alongside them and just do some hard work and, you know, really make a difference, because the beautiful thing about what these guys are going to do is they're going to use the space to learn, you know, a bit about gardening, so they develop their social skills. But then what they're going to do is give the space back to the community, so that the community of Ridgeray can use it for like social gatherings and various different things. So such a beautiful thing. They've been given the space and then they want to give it back. So long story short, my back and my neck is absolutely killing me. I must live such a sedentary lifestyle, just sitting beside a desk or sitting on my backside all day, because I think I've got muscles that I didn't realise were there. And, you know, although I was there as I was one of the organisers of the events, so I was there and sort of supervising, but I wanted to muck in, I wanted to actually get some work done, so I've been shoveling some stone for the path, and I was on wheelbarrow duty for, they were getting rid of some, they had some weeds that needed to be, you know, the ground needed to be sort of destroyed, it couldn't be sort of recycled, it couldn't be composted. So I was on wheelbarrow duty with that, and oh my goodness, I've got muscles in the back, between my shoulder blades that are screaming at me at the moment. So I'm a bit sore and a wee bit crabby at the moment. But yeah, apart from that, yeah, things are good, sir. Things are good.
In the 21st century, No one's quite sure what they want to be. Don't change.
All right, on the phone with me today is Greg Garrett. He is a professor of English at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. He's a writer in residence at the Episcopal Theological Seminary of the Southwest, and he blogs at theotherjesus.com. He recently came out with a book, Stories from the Edge, A Theology of Grief, and kind of talks about his stories as a chaplain in Austin, Texas, at many of the hospitals down there. And he's joining us on the phone from Austin, Texas. How are you doing today, Greg?
I'm doing great, Jonathan. It's great to be with you.
Now, you said that you're writing today. Are you working on your next big novel?
Well, I'm actually trying to finish up revisions on a novel, and then I've got another book of nonfiction that's due in a couple of weeks.
Okay. Now, how many books have you actually published?
Somewhere around 10.
Okay. And one of those was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, the Free Bird.
Yeah, that's right. That was my first novel, and it was, well, apparently a lot of people liked it, which was very exciting. You wait a long time to publish a novel, and then people really enjoy it. That's a happy thing.
I imagine so. And getting the critical acclaim of a Pulitzer Prize definitely probably helps that along the process.
Well, if I were to actually win a Pulitzer Prize, that would help an awful lot. But being nominated is a pretty amazing thing, too. So.
Right. Now, how does an English professor at Baylor University end up writing a book on the doctrine or the theology of grief?
Well, it sort of happened in two ways. The first thing is that about 5 years ago, I felt this very strong calling to go to seminary. And after a long time away from organized religion, I had come back to Christianity in a big way because of some events that took place in my life, and found a community in Austin, an Episcopal church on the east side of Austin that was sort of life-saving for me. And part of my recovery and coming back to life was this sense that I had been, you know, saved for a purpose, that there was something I was supposed to be doing. And a big part of that calling for me revolved around the idea that maybe I was supposed to go to seminary. And so I went to and graduated from the Episcopal Seminary in Austin, the Seminary of the Southwest. And one of the major things and one of the most difficult things that you have to do as part of the MDiv degree is you have to work full-time as a chaplain during one of your summers. It's a 400-hour program called Clinical Pastoral Education, where you work in a hospital, and then you get together a couple of times a week and talk about what's going on so that you can learn some things from what you're experiencing, because most of the time the things that you're experiencing are not like anything you've ever experienced before. So that was a big part for me. I really felt called to do this, and it's been an amazing experience. I learned so much that I use in my writing and my teaching and in the work I do in the church. And then this experience with being a hospital chaplain brought me face-to-face with a whole lot of things that in our culture we typically try and push away from our faces. So, you know, I was with people as they died. I was with families mourning their loved ones. I was with families as they got bad news about people they cared about. And so the job really was, how can you be with people at the worst times of their lives and in some way be the hands of Christ for them to, in some way, you know, convince them that God is still there and still working, even if things are going really badly. So that was one part of it. The experience was something that was so powerful that I knew I needed to write about it so that other people could hear about it. And that really was sort of the second thing. What I do as a writer is I tell stories or I talk about stories. I also write about nonfiction and about popular culture. So I've written books about movies. I've written books about comics and graphic novels. And what I try and do is to analyze the faith stories that we find in them, to look at them philosophically and theologically. And when I started doing that with the stories that I was hearing in the hospital, I discovered some really interesting things about the stories that people tell themselves about God and about the world, many of them being stories that kind of fall apart when they're subjected to stress and suffering. And so what I decided at the end of that summer was that I thought I could write a book growing out of the stories that I had heard and thought about in the hospital, and some of the stories from my own life and my own personal suffering, that might help people understand some different ways that they could think, especially if, as I think is true, the stories that we tell help us decide who we are in life and help us understand the way we live. I think narrative is the way that we structure our world and the way we understand things. And so I thought I would take a look at some of these sort of controlling narratives in our lives about God or about American myths, and tell these stories in ways that people could recognize them and give them a chance to reflect on them and maybe find a story that would hold together better for them when bad times come.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to definitely get more into that through the, I guess, through our discussion. But one of the things that you mentioned was, I think you said that you wanted to debunk some of the ideas or some of the misconceptions we might have about God or suffering. And the way that I found out about you is actually through your blog, The Other Jesus. And so do you? I get the impression that you might say, you know, we might be following the wrong Jesus, or maybe we're drinking the wrong Kool-Aid. Is that something that you're seeing in, I guess, in your faith and going through seminary and working at Baylor and so forth?
Well, I think for a lot of people, yes. I think a lot of people are wrestling with ideas of God and of Jesus and of Spirit and of the church that they've gotten that, for whatever reason, are not satisfying for them. And to be honest, I'm not out to convert somebody who's got a perfectly good God. My grandma, for example, is 86 years old. She's been a member of the Assembly of God for 55 years. And whenever she comes across a contradiction in the way she thinks about God or the way she reads the Bible, she just sort of floats right over it. And that is fine with me. You know, at 86 years old, if God is working for her, if her faith is a living faith, then, you know, there's absolutely no reason she should change it. And there are other people in my family who grew up in the same very sort of conservative evangelical tradition that I grew up in who are doing just fine. And, you know, I'm not setting out to convert anybody, but there are so many people who are either not satisfied with the stories that they have or who have not heard a story yet that resonates with them. And I think that's really what's important to me. I am out there for people who were like me, who were absolutely turned off by the story of God that they received, but were able to find a story of God that was powerful and transformative for them. And that's really sort of the heart of what I'm doing here. I've read some reviews that call me an evangelical, which at first I recoiled from with, you know, the most powerful feeling. And then I thought about it some more, and I thought about some other people who get called evangelical, like Jim Wallace and Brian McLaren. And I thought, you know, if that means that I talk about being a Christian and I say that it's, you know, not only okay to be a Christian, that it can absolutely change your life, if that's what evangelical means to some people, then I'm okay with that.
Okay. And now we love on our podcast to kind of, we love talking about the stories. We love sharing people's stories, but we also like getting kind of into the person behind the stories. Growing up, what was your childhood like? Were you active in the church? Were you active with Christianity? I guess with a grandmother with such a history, you probably were very active in faith of some sort.
Yeah. My parents settled on Southern Baptist, which for them was a compromise between Assembly of God, which my dad's side was, and Methodist, which my mom's side was. So that was our compromise, Southern Baptist. It doesn't seem like much of a compromise right now, but that's the tradition that I grew up in. And I'm recovering more and more things about the tradition that have been good for me. A lot of things were really bad for me. And the churches that I grew up in were really sort of toxic in their preaching and their teaching in terms of the guilt that sort of accumulated for people. And it was not a good culture to be creative or the slightest bit rebellious in. And since I was both of those, it was kind of a problem. But I was raised in the church, we were, as the old saying goes, we were in the church every time the doors opened, and that was, you know, roughly five or six times a week.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was the music director. My mom sang in the choir. And I actually started singing what they called specials, what you know, we called solos, in church when I was 10 years old, which now I think probably borders a little bit on child abuse. But I was very much involved in the life of the church and had drunk the Kool-Aid completely until my parents got divorced and the church that we were a part of was not much of a church for us in our suffering. The judgmental side of the tradition really came to the forefront. My mom was shamed out of the community, and I was treated like a sort of a sad and interesting freak, as at that time the only child of divorce in the whole church. So I was a pathfinder, I guess, for all those that followed me. But it was a tradition that I took very seriously when I was a kid. And then I was 13 when my parents divorced, and I really sort of just went to a dark place. Since that was the only tradition that I knew about Christianity, I mean, Methodist and Assembly of God were not demonstrably different in terms of what I understood about them at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I just assumed that God was this person they were telling me about who really sort of hated everybody, and that the church was this group that got together, you know, on Sundays and talked about God and then pretty much forgot about God for the rest of the week.
Mm-hmm.
So I was badly served by the tradition, and I know not all of the churches in the tradition are like that. And as I said, there are people in my family. My younger brother is a Southern Baptist minister in Alabama, and you don't get much more Southern Baptist than that. And I love them dearly, and the tradition is working really well for them. But it was sort of a disaster for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned in the book that you, I guess in your teens, you kind of started coming into this depression, maybe as you hinted there, kind of a dark side of life. Was that brought about from your parents' divorce, or were there other issues in your life that were going on at that time?
Well, what I discovered later is that actually the chronic depression that I suffered from is something that has been in my family for several generations. My mom and my granddad and my older son have also suffered from it at one time or another. And one of the things about depression is that it often has triggers, so it can be sort of floating along. I was diagnosed initially with dysthymia, which is sort of low-grade depression, which for me was sort of, you know, life is not so great, but I'm still going to get out of bed this morning because I can't think of anything else better to do. But there were some life triggers at times in my life. I've been married and divorced a couple of times, and particularly my last marriage and the breaking up of that last marriage was a trigger for me that really sent me almost to the verge of death. I came to the point of committing suicide on a couple of occasions, and just for whatever reason. A couple of times I talked with a friend who talked me out of it, and once I realized that I didn't want to hurt anybody else, and the method that I had chosen was going to hurt at least one other person. So it was something that was really sort of the controlling element of my life for many, many years. I started feeling depressed in my teen years, and I really only came to a recovery of it about 5 years ago.
Okay.
So.
And that's about the time you started. That's about the time you started the seminary. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. Shortly after that, shortly after I'd become a member of the Episcopal Church in East Austin. And so my own experience of grief and suffering is pretty profound. I mean, I know a lot about sort of ongoing and chronic suffering, and I wanted to talk about that because that's a part of many people's lives. And I've also written about that. I wrote a spiritual autobiography called Crossing Myself, which is about depression and faith and kind of what happened to me and how I got better.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did these years going through this depression, through this dark view of the world, how did it shape your overall view of God and of suffering and maybe just even the church and faith in general?
Well, it really shook up the received stories that I had been given. The God that I was taught about when I was a kid and the relationship we had with God, it was very transactional. If you do certain things, then God will do certain things. And that's part of, I think, a part of American Christianity, this sort of if-then transactional idea of God, that if we do certain things, behave in certain ways, if we go to church, if we tithe, if we help people who are needy, if we pray the prayer du jour, then when we're in trouble, God will show up for us. And, of course, you know, people can pull verses out of the Bible that say, you know, if you pray hard enough, God will give you what you want.
Mm-hmm.
But that certainly was not my experience. Even though I was far from organized religion in those days, I really clung to a belief in God because it was about all that I had. It was like all those terrible psalms, you know, where the person is crying out from the pit and going, you know, where are you, God? But at least that calling out, you know, still sort of implies a relationship. You know, I still believe that you're there. I'm still talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see you, but, you know, this is all I've got to hold on to. And so what happened for me in terms of my own faith is that during those years it shifted away from that idea of a transactional God. And then for a while I was really sort of in this place where I was thinking, well, you know, God is maybe this cosmic force because clearly God's not stepping in to turn my life around. So maybe that's what God is. But for some reason I didn't find that particularly satisfying either. And what I eventually came to was a faith in God and a really powerful belief in ecclesiology, the idea that God is working in the world through God's people, because it was God's people who took me in and rescued me and patched me up and sort of turned me around and said, okay, now go out and help somebody else.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a great view that many of us miss. And maybe we've known it, but we don't really take part in it, I guess, because I think of my own tradition and thinking of how suffering, I guess, has always been presented to me, is that you're suffering so that someone else can benefit from it. And to me, that seems a little twisted, but it's also kind of that idea that we help each other along the way. We help each other and we build each other up and we work through, you know, God is working through us to help other people. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. Although I didn't know it at the time, what I've come to is this belief in what Celtic Christianity calls the Anamkara, the soul companion, the person or persons who will journey alongside you as you travel. And what happened in my own journey was that there were a couple of people who were Christian, but they weren't Christian in the sense that they were trying to save my soul or trying to, you know, it wasn't either like Job's friends sitting around and going, well, you know, if you were a better Christian, then God would do this for you.
Mm-hmm.
They just walked alongside me, and I knew that if I needed them, they would be there. My friend Chris C., I can't tell you how many times I would call him late at night, sometimes in the middle of the night. I mean, he's got a family full of young kids. I know I wouldn't answer the phone. But he knew in those days that if I called him at that time of night that it was an emergency. And without people like him or without Greg, who was the priest in the church that I began attending in Austin, I wouldn't be here today. And it just confirmed to me the idea that God puts us here so that we can walk alongside other people. And my own theory about my own suffering now is that what it's done really is freed me to walk with people who are suffering,
mm-hmm.
and not feel like I have to explain things to them just to say, I know this sucks, but I'm here and I think God is here and we'll get this. We'll get through it.
Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned, I think you've touched on a couple of these already, but in the book you talk about some of the different views that people have as far as of God and of suffering. Can you kind of touch on those again and summarize each of those? I think there's four or five areas that you brought up in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course these arose from different stories that I heard or witnessed in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
The central question that people have when they're suffering is why. And if you're a religious person, then I think you could expand that to say, why God? Why? And so that implies an idea about God, that God is going to do something or that God has a relationship to suffering that is supposed to be different than what people are experiencing in that moment. And so what I discovered was, and this is not too surprising because these are sort of well-developed ideas about God that people would recognize, but one of them was this very, very transactional idea about God, what I described as God as Santa Claus, that if you do certain things, you're going to be on the good list and you're going to get presents, and if you do certain things, you're going to be on the bad list and get coal. And it's that that idea that our moral behavior, our piety, or whatever you want to think about, is going to determine the way that God treats us. And this is a very popular idea in my family. My grandma is a very big believer in it. And although she loves me dearly and I think thinks the very best of me, there were a couple of times when I was very sick when she would call and she would ask me about secret sin. Is there something that you have not confessed to God that is causing this in your mm-hmm. life? And so this idea of God as Santa Claus is part of, I think with almost all of these, both sacred and secular, there's sort of an if-then, kind of like, you know, computer programmers use. Mm-hmm. If you do this, then this will happen. And when then doesn't happen is when we begin to wonder, you know, if maybe we've put God into the wrong box. So God is Santa Claus. Sort of a maybe a variation of that would be what I think of as God as vending machine. You know, I prayed for this, and I got that. It's like Huck Finn talks about in The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, when I prayed for a fishing rod, but I never got one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got some needles or fishing hooks, but I never got a fishing rod. So I think we have this idea that, you know, God is sort of like a Coke machine, and we can put a dollar bill in and get a product back. And like most of these if-then statements about God, when you say them baldly like this, they sound kind of ludicrous
mm-hmm.
because we understand that we do not have power over God. The kind of if-then sort of things that we're talking about are what actually we would call magic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do this certain thing, perform this ritual, say these words, and a supernatural power will grant my boon.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe in magic. So God as Santa Claus is one of them. God as, I think in the book I called it cosmic champion. I think maybe your listeners would identify better with the idea of God as cosmic gladiator.
Mm-hmm.
I had some patients who really felt like God was supposed to step up and fight for them because they felt like death and evil were winning the day. And this is an idea that goes all the way back to the Persian idea of Manichaeism. The ancient Persians believed that there were two deities, a light deity and a dark deity who are fighting for cosmic control. And I think a lot of American Christians believe in this sort of Manichaean idea of the universe because my church certainly did growing up. My church said that the world was given to Satan and that we were in a daily and ongoing cosmic battle and God was fighting on our side and we were helping. And the thing about that is that it elevates Satan. If you believe in Satan as a supernatural entity that causes evil in the world, it elevates Satan to the status of God. To say that God and Satan are wrestling, arm wrestling, whatever you want to think about, is to deny the sort of central Christian fact that, as the Apostle Paul says, the victory has already been won, that Jesus' death and resurrection has won the battle for all time, and we are just waiting to see the end results of that. So whenever evil and death showed up and won the day, people thought that God was falling down on the job, you know, that it was God's job to prevent that from happening. And again, I think that's sort of an if-then kind of thing. A third way that we think about God that I noticed a lot was the idea of God as a parent. And this is, again, sort of transactional. If we behave as good children, then we expect God to reward us. God will buy us a pony.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a nice, I think, devotional way for us to think about God because, I mean, admittedly, God is a cosmic force that is greater than anything we can understand. But some of the things in our relationships, if we've had good relationships with our parents, can open up God for us in a really powerful way. But again, if we have that expectation, you know, if I call my mom and I'm in dire need, she will help me. And it's clear that that God as parent story doesn't always work that way. Then the fourth vision, the one that really spoke to me, that is sort of the one that I'm, I think, telling this story in my life now, is the idea of God alongside us. that I sort of got out of the idea in my own personal faith of thinking about God as here to solve my problems, and began thinking about it more in the way, especially as I thought about the life of Christ, of God accompanying us and being with us in solidarity. And again, this is something that came to me in the last couple of years through the Celtic tradition. In Celtic Christianity, God wasn't like boxed up inside a church. You know, God was sort of set free throughout creation. It was a very incarnational idea of God. Not that God was everything, but that God was present. And I found this really powerful, the idea that also shows up in a lot of those problem psalms we were talking about, that maybe God is not going to step up and solve the problem. You know, I shot off my big toe and God's not going to sew it back on for me. But God's going to be there, and God is going to, so to speak, hold my hand in a spiritual sense. And I have felt that presence in a very powerful way since I've embraced that faith story. And it really grew out of my worst depression, because I came to the point where I realized that I was not going to be able to go on living in my own strength. And I describe in the spiritual autobiography this morning when I couldn't get out of bed. And I'd had a lot of bad mornings, but that morning I just gave up.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, God, if you're there and if you're listening, I am finished. I can't do this anymore. And I'm going to have your help, whatever that looks like. Just to know that you're there is going to make all the difference to me. And something happened that morning. It was a mystical experience that would be hard to explain, as most mystical experiences are. But I had this really powerful sense that God was there. And I know later on, a couple of months later, when people asked me how I was getting through things, because my life was really pretty horrible in those days, I remember telling somebody, I get up in the morning and I walk on God all day long. So it's like God was there from the time I got up to the time I got to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And that for me has been, I think, the most powerful way of thinking about God. And again, I think it's so powerful because it's one of those stories that encompasses suffering. Most of these other stories are going to fall apart at some point, especially if you're a good person and you suffer, because these other stories don't really make room for that. Because if you're a good person and if God is who that story says that he is, the transactional God, then you shouldn't suffer. And yet, Barbara Brown Taylor, who's one of my favorite preachers, tells us that the life of Jesus shows us that you can be the best person that there ever was, and it doesn't protect you from suffering.
Right. Now, this idea of God walking alongside of us, or as you said, walking on God throughout the day, you touched on it briefly in the book, but this is kind of the idea of process relational theology. Is that correct?
There are pieces of it. I'm not myself a process theologian, and although there are some pieces of my theology that are fairly liberal, in some ways I'm fairly conservative as well. I am still open to the possibility that God may be working in an active way, because it feels like there are things that have happened in my life in which God has moved in an active way, but I don't feel able to sort of pin down in any kind of theological way or systematic way how God works or doesn't work. So my own experience seems to be that God has worked for me in the hands of other people and perhaps in some sort of supernatural way as well that I can't explain. But I liked the process idea, and I thought it might be interesting for a lot of people, especially if they were not familiar with it, because it does offer a new way to think about God that might be an escape from some of those boxes that might not be working for people.
Mm-hmm.
So I presented it not because it's necessarily my own theology, but because I thought it might be a story of God that would be meaningful for people.
And just kind of as a plug for another podcast, the Homebrewed Christianity podcast talked, they had a two-part show that basically discussed a lot more of that. So you can definitely, for those listeners that aren't familiar with the idea of process relational theology or process theology, definitely be sure and check that out, find out more on that. Do you think that there's... Go ahead.
No, I was going to just second that. I think that this is an idea of God that for many people could be very powerful. And one of the things that this sort of idea remedies for many of us is a traditional American faith, which is mostly about us sort of sitting around and waiting for God to do something.
Mm-hmm. Do you find value in each of these different views? Do you think that they're, I mean, some of the views that you may not necessarily agree with, or that, you know, as you mentioned, may fall apart at some part or at some point, do you still find value in them, or do you think that other people should still continue to look for value in these ideas?
Well, I will confess to you that most of the stories that I tell in this book are stories that I think don't work. And I would guess that if you were to take a look, I don't know, maybe there are 12 or 15 different stories, sort of meta-narratives or controlling narratives that I talk about. And the whole idea behind the book really was to get them out in front of people so that they could recognize them in their own lives. And again, if people are finding meaning in this, then I'm not here to convert somebody. Mm-hmm. But I think some of these stories really are pretty toxic. The idea, for example, that some Christians have, that if you're being punished, that it's because you've done something wrong, I think is a really toxic idea of God and of relationship with God. And in the same way, when you think about some of the secular stories, however satisfied you might be with your iPod and your high-definition TV, I think you're really ignoring the important things that are supposed to be happening in existence if that's where your happiness is coming from. So when we think about some of those secular stories as well, the stories of consumerism, of technology and progress, of power, I think that those are spiritual dead ends.
Mm-hmm.
So I would definitely come out against the secular stories, and then I think even with some of the sacred stories. You know, as I said, my grandma has this particular set of beliefs that is working for her, and no one could talk her out of her beliefs at this point. So, you know, it gets her through the day, and she's living a life that's meaningful for her. And so, you know, it's not for me to step in and say, but Grandma, you could do better.
Thing that comes to me, Jonathan, when I've been listening to the interview is talk about someone making lemonade from lemons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we go through the journey and we hear about what Greg's talking about and his understanding of God, and you know, and we come into the stories he's talking about, here's someone who's actually been there, you know, that has lived this on the edge and, you know, has really suffered so that in some way he can be there for others who are suffering. And without sort of downplaying his experience, you know, we look time and time again, you see people that have gone through experiences, whether they be, you know, in this situation, real periods of suffering or real joyous experiences or experiences that the individual hasn't realized why they were going through that experience in the time, but then later in hindsight, suddenly they realize and fully understand what they've done. There's a wee woman, and I do say she's wee, she's smaller than me, and I must be smaller than Laurie. She is a wonderful, wonderful example. She actually lost her son. Her son died in a motorcycling accident. And so she went through this real period of suffering and grief. But now she's moved on. She, you know, she still suffers, but she understands it a bit more. And she now sort of helps others who are going through such an experience. Very low-key, very, you know, no attention being drawn to what she does, but she just sort of builds up relationships, communicates with people that are suffering, and basically, as Greg talks about, this sort of God coming alongside us, this here she was doing God's work in such a simple and, you know, human way, and it's just so, you know, it's beautiful to hear the story when it comes to the conclusion. And you know, she is one of these people that is making lemonade for God from the lemons that she's been given, and that just is just really inspirational. So, you know, one of the things I don't know if you caught this, but it was a phrase that Greg uses very early on in the interview when he talks about his recovery and coming back to life. You know, this wasn't someone that was just coming back to faith. He was coming back to life. And that really stood out for me. This one phrase just really stood out for me. And then when you listen to the story, when you listen to about, you know, the fact that he had this depression, that he was really, really depressed and suicidal on a number of occasions, but yet this phrase comes out that he had this relationship with God, even though he didn't know who God was and what God was. He had this relationship that, you know, that it was almost like that's all he had. And what a tremendous experience, you know. And I'm glad that he's come through it and he's got to the other side. And he's using this experience as a real positive thing for good and for God. That just that phrase that God was all that he had. And I just wish sometimes that we all had an experience whereby we got to that point where God was all that we had, because I think we would be all better people and more, you know, more committed followers if we come to that realization that not only is God all that we need, sometimes God is all that we have. So I thought that was that. I picked that point up in when he was talking about the experience. So yeah, no, very much this whole lemonade kind of thing coming through. But
yeah,
what did you throw back a question when he's talking about this? He's talking about some of the stories, and he's talking about the first one about, say, God as Santa, this whole transactional experience. How did you take that? Is that something that you'd be aware of?
Well, you know, I think, like he said, you kind of live out these stories and you live out these framing stories your whole life, and you have God kind of in this box and in this description. And it's not until you really step back and, like, that story crashes or the story crumbles that you really realize what you've been doing. You know, I spoke with my mom briefly about the book, even before the interview, and I was telling her how, you know, what stood out to me was the transactional God that we have and the Santa Claus God that we have. And she's like, oh, well, I don't do that. And, you know, and it may be something that she's never done, but to me it was something that I think for a long time, that's kind of how I viewed God, was that if I do good, then he'll take care of me, and if I do bad, then he'll punish me, or I won't get the good blessings. And there's a family in our church that's gone through a whole lot in the last, 2-3 years. And the mother, she's older, both the parents, these are parents of my friends. The mother's gone through, she's just found out that she has Graves' disease. And the dad just found out that he has prostate cancer. And the son has really, he's a really good friend of mine, and he's gone through a lot. He's been involved with drugs and some trouble with the law and so forth. And when he found out that his dad had cancer, his comment was to me was that, I feel responsible for this. I feel like this is my doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's, you know, it didn't take long before kind of say, no, that's not the right thing, because we don't live in a contract with God. It's not a if-then statement. It's not, you know, as long as I live my life correctly, then God will bless me. That's not the way he works. But yet we still tend to get caught up in that trap. And I think we do that with all of our relationships. We do that with husbands and wives. We do that with friends and coworkers and neighbors. It's like, you know, I'll mow my front yard. And I'll think, well, I'll be nice, and I'll mow my neighbors, you know, the side of their yard there, since it's kind of the same grassy area. But if they don't mow, you know, repeat that and do the same thing for me when they mow, then I'm like, oh, well, I guess I won't do that again. You know, it's that if-then statement. Well, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. And we relate to people that way, and so then we relate to God that way.
Definitely.
And I don't think that's the Christian way or the Christ way of doing things. The Christ way is, I'm going to die on the cross regardless of whether you pay me attention or not, or whether you give me thanks or not. I'm going to do it for you because I love you.
No, totally.
And Christ calls his followers to do that as well.
Totally. It was just when he was saying it, it was like this sort of light bulb came on in my head, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, that's, I'm so familiar with that. I'm so familiar with that understanding. It's like as people that we just cannot concept, we cannot understand the concept of unconditional love, that we cannot understand, you know, because life is so conditional. You know, you pay your fare, you ride on the train. We complain about those people that don't pay their fares. We complain about those people that don't pay their taxes. We complain about those people that do X, Y, and Z. But, you know, and get away with it. We have this concept of getting away with it, that some people can get away with murder. And we don't have this understanding of unconditional love. We don't have this understanding of you know what all that means, and it is very much when we talk about that whole if then statement. When Greg talks about this whole transactional idea of, well, if I do this then this, if I do this then that,
yeah,
and that whole idea that if you're suffering that you've done something wrong. And I can understand the toxicity. That's a hard word for me to get out. But that whole, you know, the toxic nature of these ideas, that in some way that we are, you know, because of what we're doing or because of our actions, we offend God in such a way that He, you know, He reacts against it, even though He gave His own, you know, His only Son to die for us in the first place. You know, I mean, how can we balance up the two? Because if you know if we were going to be doing something that was so heinous and so bad, then well, to be honest, the Lord would be more conditional with His love. But it just doesn't work that way. That His love is so unconditional, and we just can't work that out. So when He was talking about that, when He was talking about that whole transactional thing, you know. As you're saying about the people that suffer, and you know, and I'm sorry to hear that. I look back at some of the real heroes in my life, the real heroes of faith. I think of a woman called Eleanor, who was this old dear woman when I lived in Livingston, and she lived with such sort of pain, not only physical pain. She had cancer and various things. She was frail. She was like Yoda, except she wasn't green. Well, maybe actually she was green at times. She just didn't have big ears like Yoda. But, you know, she was this frail character, but yet she was so strong in the Lord because she was dependent on Him, literally was dependent on Him. And then I think about the Bill and Nancy Stockwell. On my blog, you'll see a quote from Bill about the archers. And Bill lived for many, many years with lymphoma, this really bad cancer. And that didn't stop him from doing the stuff that he did. That didn't stop him from getting out and, you know, teaching and really helping others and to walk alongside God. And, you know, Bill was a real example for that. And this was a very successful doctor who was cut down by cancer that couldn't work and had to take early retirement. And if you think in these transactional terms, you know, I mean, you'd think, well, what has he done wrong? But you know, Bill was such a hero in the faith for me, and you know that you just can't think of it in these terms, as if but sort of if then scenario. So I think when he walks through that, and then you know you've got the very similar one about God as a parent, you know, and having two kids, you know, the 9-year-old Dana and the 7-year-old Miriam. You know, I mean, Miriam can be at times an absolute nightmare. And she'll remember the least wee thing. If you mention sweeties or candy, just once she will remember it. But if you tell her a million times to clean her room or move her clothes, or she'll forget all about it, you know. And we think about it in these terms, you know what I mean? But just because she, you know, just because she's messy and kind of cheeky and a wee imp, and same with Dana, it doesn't mean I love them any less. It's not, my love isn't a conditional love for them. And, you know, we think in these terms as God is Santa, God is parent. And that makes sense to me in these terms. And so when we look at the last one he was talking about God alongside us, about God's people working in this world, you know, it makes sense. I can I think there's maybe truth in all the different stories. There's maybe a wee bit about the power of God in everything, but certainly when you look at that, God working through his people, that he isn't this impersonal cosmic force. He isn't this person that we need to appease. You know, he's just wanting the very best for us. And I can still get the metaphor of God as parent, and I think he will. You know, we are disciplined at times. I think there's times when we need to learn important lessons, and if we're too thick or too, you know, selfish, sometimes that we are, you know, we are taught a lesson for the reason of it being a lesson to develop us, just as parents do. But this God alongside us, this is, you know, that whole idea of solidarity coming alongside us and working with us and, you know, working through us, is just such an awesome concept for us, and it just really puts what we're here on this planet to do and to be into context that bit more. You know what I mean? We're out there to preach the gospel, the good news to the poor. Yes, but we're there to you know, reject oppression and to fight against oppression and to comfort those that need our help, and to heal the sick, and mm-hmm. you know, to heal the brokenhearted, and to really get in there and, you know, get our hands dirty and get muddy and bloody and covered in whatever, because that's what we're called to be. Is we're called to be in this world. And yeah, when I'm hearing Greg talking about it, when you hear about Greg, you know, talking about walking alongside people and walking with people who are suffering, and just sort of whispering, you know, look, I know we'll get through this. It's, you know, you realise here's somebody that's been put through has gone through an ordeal, but yeah, is now making something of that ordeal, you know. And for me, that was really, 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 really impressive. And I'm really glad that, you know, I've been able to hear certainly that part of the interview. We'll talk more about the second part of the interview next week, but certainly it's been another inspirational story, Jonathan. Another ordinary radical doing extraordinary work. What, 400 hours he had to do as a chaplain? Wow. You
know, yes.
That's impressive.
Yeah. Very great story and a very good book. Definitely encourage people to go out and pick that up. Stories from the Edge, Theology of Grief by Greg Garrett. And appreciate him spending some time with us this week. And we'll follow up. He had a second part of the interview. We spoke for about an hour, so we thought we would divvy that up a little bit. And we will share the second part of his interview next week right here on the podcast. So, Thomas, I hope that your nephew gets to feeling better. I know that anytime you start speaking about children in hospital, it gets to be a little fearful and worrisome. And so I hope that everything goes well and the jaundice isn't anything serious. It seems like more and more, I wasn't real familiar with jaundice until the last year or so. It seems like more and more kids that I know are being born with it, but you know, I'm just like, where did this come from? But apparently it's also something that's pretty easy to they can take care of. So
I think Nathan just needs a good dose of the sun. But unfortunately, yep, he's been born into the wrong country. The sun is one thing that we don't get a lot of. Mm-hmm. I think if kids were born and what they needed was rain, then I think you would find a lot of kids being born now in Scotland. I think it's been the wettest whatever and however long here. But yeah, I think he needs sun. He just needs some, and I think that's what he's getting, some phototherapy. So just to heal, yeah, you know, just to get a bit of healing. But the crazy thing is again, and here I'm talking about Twitter once more, but the one thing that's just wonderful about Twitter is you put out a tweet that says, look, you know, My nephew's got jaundice, please pray, and people do. And if anything, that's just a wonderful example of how this whole concept of co-presence really, really works for Christians and for believers that are able to just take time out just to say a little prayer. It's that connection. So yeah, yeah. So thanks to everyone who's listening that, you know, has in some way, you know, helped out, and greatly appreciate that. So Jonathan, thank you for your time. Thank you for this, you know, for another great interview. Greg's a really good guy, and I really look forward to reading his book. I haven't had the chance to read his book, but I really look forward to reading his book, and I'd recommend, you know, everyone check it out. There'll be links in the blog on the Something Beautiful website for his book and stuff, yeah?
Yep, and we do have a Something Beautiful podcast Twitter stream, actually, since you mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
They can actually check that out. It's twitter.com and SB Podcast. And also, if you're using Twitter and you want to advertise Twitter, you know, tell your friends about it. There's a tiny URL. It's tinyurl.com/SB Podcast. And so you can easily just, and that'll take people right to the front page. So you can tell all your friends about it, put that in your Twitter feed, and they'll take them directly to our podcast website.
Excellent. Well, it's good to speak to you, my friend.
Yeah, you too, and I look forward to catching up with you next week, and we'll listen to more from Greg Garrett on the podcast.
Excellent. You take care, sir.
All right, take care. I'm going to go catch a bus.
Hey.
All right, have a great evening, Thomas.
Okay, buddy, I'll send the audio on you, man. Thanks again.
All right, no problem. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Listening to the Something Beautiful podcast. Join us again next week at somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.
If there's a God, he's embarrassed, and it's no secret why. Only thing that he can